This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. College students today are facing an uncertain future. We hear more and more about the importance of getting a top-notch education and how increasingly careers in science, technology, engineering, and math offer the only promise of a successful road forward. But as STEM fields are touted as the path to a bright future, and Ivy League colleges are the place to study them, has the importance of the humanities been forgotten? In his new book, Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life, author Bill Derezowitz claims that it has. He also argues that the environment of these top schools is one of such fierce competition and fear of failure that it actually takes a measurable toll on the students' mental health.
There's this pressure to always be constantly busy and constantly doing things. It's rooted in this, like, fear of failure that is, like, rooted in not only the students but perpetuated by the university. The kids that are at these schools are kids that have succeeded in everything their whole life, and so they're terrified of failure. They have no, their own personal values aren't set, because we live in a culture here where it's more important to do things right than to do the right things.
That was Christine, a freshman at Yale University in New Haven, echoing a few of the sentiments in Bill's book. We'll hear from other students at Yale throughout the course of the hour, and we want to hear from you as well at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. We're going to lay out the argument that Bill Derezowitz makes in his book, painting a bleak picture, arguing that the Ivies and other elite schools focus on molding students into single-minded careerists, skilled at networking, number crunching, and resume building, but ill-equipped to think creatively or meaningfully about the world around them. What do you say? Are you a student yourself, or perhaps somebody preparing a student for an elite school? We'd love to hear your voice in this conversation. 860-275-7266. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Bill Derezowitz is the author of Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and The Way to a Meaningful Life. He joins us on the phone from California today. Bill, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So explain to our listeners who these excellent sheep are.
Yeah, I should say that was actually a phrase that came out of the mouth of one of my students at Yale when I was still teaching there as a description of herself and her peers. And it's perfect, because these students are excellent at being students. This isn't just about college. I want to emphasize that this is even more about how students are trained to become the kinds of kids who can get into top schools. And I think any parent out there, or certainly many parents out there listening to the show, will understand what I'm talking about, that the preparation for the admissions process really starts not even in ninth grade or seventh grade, but sometimes in fifth grade or first grade, where you know that you have to mold the whole of your child's childhood and adolescence with that goal in mind. And what that means is sending them through an endless series of academic and extracurricular hoops, week after week, year after year. So these kids are incessantly trained to give the grown-ups what they want. And that's what I mean when I say that they are excellent students, in the sense that they're excellent at being students. They're excellent at giving us the answers we want and doing all the things we want them to do. Now, as a result of that, what they're really bad at is figuring out what they want out of life, how to make their own choices, how to pursue their own curiosity in a more single-minded and genuine way, how to find a sense of purpose. And as a result, they tend to either flounder around after graduation without any idea of what to do, or they'll follow one of the really four career paths that have become the dominant career postgraduate directions: law, medicine, finance, and consulting at Ivy League and other top colleges. And then they grow up to become our leadership class, which is the last thing I talk about in the book. You know, this is not just about individual students and the lives that they are taught to lead. It's about all of us, because, you know, these are, you know, elite schools really do prepare our elite, and they're the ones making decisions for the rest of us.
So we heard from the student Christine on the Yale campus, and this quote just sticks with me. She says, "We live in a culture where it's more important to do things right than to do the right things." This really is echoed throughout your book, but I'd like you to talk about how whether it's the Ivy League colleges or our society in general, has determined what those right things are that Christine and other students are just meant to do.
Yeah, and again, I want to emphasize, this is not just the colleges. I talk about the colleges partly because that's where my experience is, partly because this is the first chance students have to be autonomous, and partly because they're very important within this whole system. But it is a big, giant system with lots of different actors all pushing in the same direction and all acting on each other to keep doing what they're doing. And the most important actor is really the larger social norms and values that shape what we've taught students to want out of their education, what we've taught people to want out of life. And in a word, we can call that success, as long as we understand that success has come to be defined in very narrow terms as you know, basically maximizing wealth, status, prestige, and power, rather than fulfillment. And to a great extent, this is a system that forces people to choose between success and fulfillment.
We're talking with Bill DeResiewicz, whose book is Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. We're going to get to some of your phone calls in a bit at 860-275-7266. If you feel as though this system that he is describing is something that you or your student is a part of, we'd like to hear your thoughts. You can also email us, wherewelive@wnpr.org, tweet us at wherewelive. I'm wondering if you can describe when exactly this started, because American education, whether it's in high school or pre-high school or certainly even at elite colleges, it wasn't always this way, Bill.
Yeah, I don't want to idealize the old days, which were also days of exclusion, when you had to be an upper class, you know, WASP, white man to get into an Ivy League school by and large. But we can date the start of the new system fairly precisely, and it was the mid-60s. It really, Yale took the lead, and it was a really kind of a revolutionary change in the way colleges admitted students and who they were willing to admit. And that's when we pivoted from what used to be called the WASP aristocracy, the sort of prep school system, to what we now call meritocracy, which is multicultural, includes both genders. It's open to everyone in theory. What's happened gradually, as the meritocracy has matured, is that the winners in the system, the meritocrats, have figured out how to perpetuate their own privilege through the system. So the system is still in theory open to everyone, but everybody knows that it takes more and more money, not just to pay for college. And after all, top schools often have very generous financial aid packages, but to produce a student who's capable of getting into one of those colleges is enormously expensive. You have to send them to a fancy private school, or you have to live in a fancy suburb that has a great public school. You have to give them all kinds of enrichment activities, tutors, coaches, test prep, foreign travel, sports equipment, musical equipment. This is the problem. And so these schools really once acted to mitigate privilege and to increase social mobility. And gradually that's become less and less true, and they've become more and more socioeconomically stratified. So I want to emphasize, this is not the last 10 years. This is not kids today. This is the last 50 years. I went through the system. Probably a lot of your listeners went through the system in one fashion or another. It just keeps getting worse and worse and worse.
So what does this show up like in the applications process? You've spent some time digging into that and looking at the applicants who come into elite schools. What do those applications look like, and what are the people who are letting kids in, the gatekeepers, what are they looking for?
Right. I did a stint on the Yale Admissions Committee, a very short stint, which is how they do it with faculty at Yale. But it gave me a peek inside the system, and it just confirmed what I had already been seeing. The admissions officers are acting in the best faith imaginable. I mean, they're really great, hardworking, smart people, and they're doing what the colleges want them to do. But what the colleges, the way the system has evolved, and I don't even think it's necessarily rational after a certain point, is that the more you have, the better. So if you have, I mean, when I got into an Ivy League college in 1981, me and the other kids who got into top schools would have like 3 APs and 3 extracurricular activities. And now it might be 7 or 8 APs and 9, 10, or 11 extracurricular activities. When a kid came before the admissions committee and the kid had only 6 or 7, you'd think 6 or 7 extracurriculars are a lot. That was already a strike against them because it indicated an insufficient ambition. So, you know, I mean, it's the music and the sports and what they call service. and what they call leadership. You know, you can't just participate in student government, you have to be running it. And it creates this kind of very well-documented adolescence. New York Times writes about this, there are books about this. Super high-stressed kids who don't have enough time to sleep, don't have enough time for personal relationships, but most importantly, don't know why they're doing all the hard work they're doing. That's the issue. It's not about working hard. It's about why you're doing it. And if you're doing it for reasons that are externally imposed that you don't fully understand, if you're just trying to get from 1 week to the next or even 1 day to the next, that creates a kind of mental distress, kind of psychological stress, that we didn't used to put kids through, and no kid should have to be put through. And there are actually a lot of statistics about the explosion of mental health issues among affluent, high-achieving high school and college students.
Our producer, Josh Nalea, toured Yale's campus and talked with some students about some of the pressures they're feeling along these lines. Let's hear some of these voices.
So would you say that overall there's too much pressure to succeed being put on Ivy League students?
Oh, yeah. You know, there always comes that time at when you're having dinner with someone where they're like, oh, I got to bounce. It's been 45 minutes, and that's the only time that I have to devote to, you know, social interactions or whatever before they have to go run off and do things.
For Ivy League students, we've had a pressure to succeed our whole life, so that pressure kind of continues through to our Ivy League education.
I think that as a generation, we're under a lot of pressure to do our best and to succeed, and I think that's okay, and that for me personally, it has pushed me forward to do my best work.
Yeah, I kind of do. You know, I have a lot of friends who have to go home and work because, you know, they can't afford to not work and not pay for part of the tuition next year, and they're telling me, like, they feel so, like, left out and so, like, unsuccessful because they're not doing, you know, these, like, grand internships they hear other kids doing.
I'd say that there's a lot of pressure, but, you know, you could make different arguments as to whether that's coming from the reputation of the schools that we go to or whether that is the kind of pressure that we put on ourselves, and that's one of the things that led to us being here in the first place. I've definitely learned my own ways of dealing with it.
Like what?
Just being very selective about what you care about, taking the long view and realizing that some things don't have as great a significance as you believe they do.
Those are some voices from the Yale campus as we talk with William DeResowitz, the author of Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. Before we get to some phone calls, I'd like you to comment on some of those voices from the Yale campus we just heard, Bill.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally in line with what students around the country have been telling me, what researchers have been finding. It sounds like the last kid is beginning to figure it out, that you actually have choices and that you don't have to do all the things that your environment it seems to be forcing you to do.
You talked about, you know, in the applications process, though, this notation that someone might make about a student not having sufficient ambition because they don't take on enough extracurricular activities to really get into an elite school. One thing I've always found interesting is this idea of what ambition really means when you're 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. I mean, what are you ambitious about? Are you ambitious because you believe that your parents are paying for a college education and you need to be something specific, or are you ambitious about things that you love? Do you even know what you love when you're 18 years old? I think this is a big question that maybe some of these students aren't grappling with in the right way.
Well, that's exactly right. They're not being helped to figure out what they really care about, which, you know, listen, when you're 18, it may be in an embryonic form, but you still have interests, you still have potential passions or purposes that will flower as an adult. And instead, what the system has been developing, and people have written about this for a long time, that the characteristic product of this meritocratic system is empty ambition. You want to be important. You want to be on the top of something, but you don't know what that something is. That's what's so ironic, right? It's exactly what you just said. Student said to me, I quoted him in the book, you can't ask a Yalee to find their passion. They have a passion only for success and hobbies and everything else. And that's the problem, is that the passion becomes just for the next credential or the next shiny name to, you know, boast about, to, you know, feel superior to your peers about, to please your parents about. Not any kind of inner purpose.
We're going to talk in the next segment about the humanities and how perhaps they're being shortchanged in this goal for success. We'll bring in Brian Garston, who is chair of the humanities program at Yale University. And we'll also continue our conversation with Bill DeResiewicz, whose book is called Excellent Sheep. We'll take some of your phone calls as well. We'd like to hear your thoughts about this. 860-275-7266. We'll get to those calls right after this break, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking with the author of a controversial book called Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. Bill DeResiewicz joins us from California today on the phone. He's a former professor of English at Yale University, and he's raised quite a few eyebrows talking about elite colleges and what it takes to get into them, the sort of experience that students are having, whether or not they are getting the meaningful lives that perhaps they want out of their educations. If you want to join us at 860-275-7266, you can. Let's go first to Kathy in Cheshire. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What's up?
I just wanted to comment. I had a family member who attended Yale. He was a very grounded individual, very community-spirited, minded. Went to Yale undergrad and Yale law, took a year off to go to the Peace Corps. I don't really think you can blame the university. I think you have to look at the family that they come from and the nurturing environment that they grow up in, who kind of teach those values to the students and then carry them throughout life, as well as accomplishing academically.
Kathy, thank you very much for that. And Bill, I'm just wondering if you can address that very quickly, because this idea that I think some may get from our conversation is that all students who want to go to elite colleges are all having exactly the same sort of experiences growing up. Their families are all very, very driven in the same way, and that you can paint with a broad brush the students who are getting into Yale or Princeton or Harvard. Kathy's saying there's a different experience out there. Just respond to what she had to say.
Sure. Listen, there are obviously exceptions. And, I mean, I taught some of them, and I'm still friends with some of them. There's a wide range of experience. I'm trying to describe what I think I have good reason to believe is the normal or typical product of the system. I will also say that those students who seem most exceptional, the factor that they had in common was precisely that they came from a different kind of family and parents who instilled different values. But it's also not that simple. I don't, as I said before, this is not just about the colleges. It's a big system, lots of people making choices. But their choices affect each other, right? The choices that the colleges make affect the choices that families make. And I've heard from a lot of parents who've said, I want to raise my kid differently, but I feel that I have to do this if I'm going to give them the best chance to have a successful life.
I want to bring into the conversation Brian Garston. He's a professor of political science and the humanities and chair of the humanities program at Yale University. He's also the author of Saving Persuasion, A Defense of Rhetoric and Judgment. Brian, welcome to the program, and thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're going to talk a bit about the role of the humanities at elite colleges and Ivy League colleges in just a moment. But first, I'd like to get your overall response to some of the conversations so far about the fact that, indeed, we do seem to be training people to have a very specific sort of resume before they get into Yale University. People who are driven in a way but maybe don't exactly understand what they want to get out of their experience at the end. What do you say about this idea of excellent sheep, Brian?
Well, look, I think the book has certainly tapped into something real. Students do feel incredibly ambitious, incredibly driven to succeed. It's true they're not sure what that success means. You know, as a teacher, I see that basically as our opportunity. The question is the kind of ambition they have the sort that gets in the way of their being opened up, or is it great material for us to work with? And I think of it that way. I think, in my experience, the students who we have in this humanities major, in a great program called Directed Studies, which is for first-year students, they're often the sort of students you can get inside their ambition, open it up, work with it, and they're willing to work so hard, and they're curious. So what you've got to do, really, is to tell them to slow down, to let them feel like they can slow down and really dive into something, choose not to do certain things. And, you know, my experience with the students is that, yes, they come in anxious and driven. They're 18 years old, though. Of course they haven't worked everything out. And it's our job as professors, teachers, to help them work these things out.
Describe a bit more about what you think ambition means and how it how it manifests itself at Yale University, at least with the students you work with, Brian?
Right. Well, this is the great question. And I have to say, this is a question that you can read about in thousands of years of literature. I mean, how to take ambitious young people and broaden their sense of what counts as success. I mean, that's a question that comes up in some of the very old books I teach. Ancient Greek philosophers write about Socrates dealing with this question. It comes up throughout history. And I think the fundamental questions actually haven't changed that much. There are socially provided answers always in any society to what counts as success. And there's a moment of kind of late adolescence when young people have a chance to step back from those conventions with the help of older people, books, and think for themselves. So the question is about our curricula and about the systems we have in place for encouraging interactions between students and mentors and teachers.
But these socially provided influences from the outside seem to suggest to an awful lot of the American public, certainly those growing up in more affluent suburbs, places where success has always been rewarded, that there is a certain type of success that is your goal at the end. It may be purely financial. It may be financial as well as other things. And that outside thing that comes from outside the walls of Yale University or any elite prep school, that's what it seems to me you're saying is driving an awful lot of these students' decisions. That there's some societal forces at work. They're saying, here's what this success looks like. Go after that.
Of course. But I would say the very fact that so many students have responded to Bill's book shows that they're not quite content with that. It shows that there's a part of many of them, at any rate, who sense that in college, this is their moment to step back and think about things for themselves. Now, that's not to say that they all succeed in gaining distance or that many of them don't come back to some of these socially provided goals. Look, some of those goals are not all bad. We do need some lawyers, we need some bankers, and so on. So I think we should look not only at how many people choose those career paths that Bill points out, but also at what sort of people they are, what sort of lawyers and bankers we have, in addition to hoping that people go on and become teachers and other things. So I hope that we have I'm married to a lawyer with a soul, I think. So I think it's possible.
you actually have evidence that this could exist. But Bill, would you like to pick up on that? Do you have a thought?
Sure. Well, to respond to everything that Brian has been saying, and I know Brian, and he's exactly the kind of professor mentor that students should be getting and should be seeking in college. The problem is that kind of pedagogy is often actively discouraged. Now, it depends on the school. It depends on the college. Yale has certain structures like the directed studies program that encourage this kind of teaching. But everybody knows, everybody in academia knows, that professors at research institutions, which is what all of these prestigious colleges are part of, are actively discouraged from spending one more second than they need to with their students because it takes away time from the research program, which is what they're rewarded for. So in every one of these schools, you have wonderful people like Brian and wonderful students who are seeking professors like Brian, but all of those people tend to have to work against the larger logic of the institutions they're part of. We were talking about, you know, trying to develop different ideas of success. Okay, great. But when it comes time for students to visit career services offices or for recruiters to come to campus showing them different vocational options, those environments are dominated by the wealthy employers, the banks, the consulting companies. I would also include Teach for America. You know, for me, Brian is right. This is not about whether you become a banker or a lawyer, but why you do it and what kind you become. Teach for America, which everybody sees as this great kind of moral, you know, cleansing process of the elite, is just another one of those things. It's just another prestige name to get on your resume. I think we do need to look at the kinds of bankers that the system has been producing. We've seen very clearly over the last 10 years what kind of bankers the system has been producing. This is the problem.
Well, but and Brian, isn't that a piece of it, though? And we've talked on this program before about the idea of schools, medical schools, employing the humanities in a new way to try specifically to get doctors to realize that it's more than just a slab of meat that you're cutting into. It's a real person who's going to have feelings about the thing that's going on there. And that at some schools is a pretty it's a pretty difficult pull, but it's an important thing. Could you talk about that, about a school like Yale turning out more bankers and lawyers and even doctors who have this basic humanities background so that they are able to act in these high-paying professions in a way that's maybe more humane, more ethical, more thoughtful?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, I think one of the strengths of parts of Yale is the way it combines the humanities with other fields. So you mentioned the program, which is well known, in which the medical school works with the museums so that they can help develop doctors' observational abilities. They also work with the School of Nursing, and the School of Music works with nurses on listening. It helps in listening to rhythms of heartbeats, as well as listening to patients. There are lots of examples of this. There's a pretty new Center for Engineering, Innovation and Design, where they have students build instruments in one class. Musical Acoustics and Instrument Design is the class. So students built a xylophone, composed music for it. They combine the sciences and the humanities. So on that level, there's a lot going on in which the humanities are linked to other fields. But look, the other point that Bill brought up, which is worth talking about, is to what extent are faculty members incentivized, organized, or at least given the space to devote their time to mentoring students and to working with them in small settings, which we know are the best ones in which you can really engage with students as individuals and bring about the kind of transformations that both Bill and I hope that they can find. And that's an area on which Yale does a pretty good job. But all universities really could do more in terms of finding resources, devoting them to that core activity of college life, and not to the ancillary things around it.
If you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Jerry is calling from New London, Connecticut. Hello there, Jerry. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I did have a big chuckle when you folks were talking about the extracurricular activities, because I work at a high school, and I'm seeing how this is trickling down to high school clubs and activities, because, you know, so many students will add very many curriculum activities, but not fully participate. So, in other words, they can put it down that they were a member, you know, on their college application. But in reality, they will show up sporadically or, you know, even not at all if they get accepted to the college of their choice. Because, you know, how can you really be in three different clubs that meet on a Monday, for instance? So I see the kids kind of playing the game, you know, to get where they want to go. But, you know, still, it's playing a game, not really fully participating.
Jerry, thanks for raising that. And actually, Bill, it reminds me of something that I think was in your book or in one of the essays that you've written about this. A student who talks about her boyfriend being the type of guy who hears about books and wants to read the beginning and the end of the book so he can talk about them at parties and be part of the social conversation about the book, but isn't really all that interested in reading the book because it takes too much time away from, you know, all the other things that he's supposed to be doing.
Yeah, and listen, again, granted that there are exceptions, that there are kids who are different, but I have found across a wide range of schools that students either aren't interested in ideas for their own sake or are interested in ideas for their own sake but feel they don't have the time, basically don't have the time to think about what they're learning because they're so busy doing everything they're doing. And the other point that Jerry made I think is really important to underscore, which is that the system tends to inculcate an enormous cynicism about education, that education is just sort of, like one student said to me, like a video game where you just need to get to the next level. You know, the kids know what we're asking them to do, and I think especially at the high school level, it's really become profoundly cynical.
Quickly, Brian, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just had a thought about this. I think, yeah. Interestingly, part of it comes from the curriculum that we've got going on, which is one that really emphasizes student choice. Now, choice is great because it lets the students explore. The problem is sometimes, because of their ambition, exploring means doing as much as possible. So you have double majors, you have triple, students wanting to triple major. You have them trying to keep as many options open as they can. And of course, the thing you want to do as a teacher is to tell them to slow down and to just focus on a couple things at a time and go much more deeply. But the problem is that our curriculum as a whole doesn't always give a lot of guidance as to what sort of things it would make sense to slow down and focus on.
So how does that change? I mean, how does either the curriculum change or the structure change or the advisement process change so that students are actually given the right path on how to wade through all these choices, Brian?
Right. So there's not just one path for them. But one project we have just started in this humanities program is to develop different experiments in coherence. So get faculty together to create clusters of courses that have a certain intellectual coherence and that we think will be personally meaningful to students, not as requirements, but as options, because the one question we constantly get from students is, I know I can try a little of this and try a little of that, but how do I put all of these things together into a whole that makes some sense? And absent institutional level guidance as to examples of coherent programs, students find themselves adrift and just trying to grasp as much as they can, and that can lead to a kind of superficiality sometimes.
And again, in a lot of our conversations, at least today, we're talking about schools like Yale or Harvard or elite schools. I think that much of what you just said can be widely applied and broadly applied to any higher education system. We've certainly heard this from students at community colleges. We've heard this from students at state universities as well. Let's go to some more phone calls because a lot of people want to join our conversation. Katie's in Cheshire. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Okay, so I have two daughters that both went to Choate. They are both going to graduate from college this year. And one of them kind of rebelled against the system. She got into Vassar and hated it, took a year and a half off, went to Mexico City on her own dime and taught English as a second language, and then went to a state university after that. The other one is at George Washington University, and she's the one I'm most concerned about because she is 24/7, go, go, go. She's doing a gazillion things, and I'm really concerned that after she graduates that she's going to crash and burn.
Hey, Katie, I'm wondering, what do you think is driving either of your students to do the things that they're doing, to have the ambitions to, you know, go 24/7 or to drop out of the system and try something new?
I think with my older daughter, some of it is she got a 2200 on her SATs and thought she was a failure because her classmates were getting 23s and 24s. I also think that she just rebelled against the system. And then my younger daughter, I'm concerned about her because she hasn't ever failed. Everything that she has ever tried her hand at has turned to gold.
Hmm. So a last question for you, Katie, and I really appreciate your phone call because I think you speak for an awful lot of people who are listening to the program right now. As a parent, do you feel, honestly, in yourself, that there's something along the way and the way your kids prepared for school or what they thought they were going to get? Is there something that you wish you would have changed along the way now that you know what you know about, you know, sending them to Choate, preparing them for elite college?
I'm not sure I would have done too much differently because I personally was one of the ones that rebelled against the system as well. I went to an elite high school and took two years off and worked in a factory and then went to the state college. So I totally get what my older daughter is doing. I don't know what I would change. I think with my younger daughter, a lot of it is internal. It comes from inside her, and she's been that way since she was an infant.
Katie, thank you again for sharing your story. I really appreciate it. And I wish both of your daughters success in their careers as they move forward. I'm quite sure that they'll both be very successful.
Thank you so much.
Bill, I want to put something to you about that. And this has to do with something we've observed and many cultural observers have been talking about quite a bit. And it has to do with the generation of students that we're talking about right now. In your book, you talk about decades of change that allowed this system to be created. But I will say that there seems to be something specifically different with what we'll call the millennial generation. And This is not just some of the highest achieving students I'm talking about, but what I just heard from Katie, the caller, is the person who's never known failure, someone who has never been told no, someone who has gotten kind of everything they want. That's not necessarily just elite college students, but it does seem to be in some ways about the generation of many young people today. Do you think, Bill, that there's something to that?
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, I want to resist that argument as much as possible because I think there's so many arguments like that. Millennials are this, millennials are that. And I think to a certain extent it's just this kind of generational competition, the way our parents were saying this about us in the 60s and the 80s. It's a system that's existed for a long time, and I'm wary of that kind of argument. I really am. It is true that it seems to be true that there are certain characteristics of millennials, but if there are, it's because of the way we've raised them, right? It's not them, it's us. And I also want to be clear, like, there are two different things we're talking about. There's that stereotype of the kid who's never told no, there are no boundaries, you know, the parent does everything for them or whatever. That's not the same as the kid who's never failed, right? And they may go together, but the kid who's never failed, that's a different problem, and that's someone who's terrified of failure. Never having failed is not necessarily a good thing. It often means that you simply have never tried anything that you knew you'd be less than perfect at. And when you've never failed, you think that failure is the end of the world instead of a necessary stepping stone to learning and growth.
That's so interesting. Brian, do you have a thought about that? Because I think about that in terms of studying sciences. I mean, in real terms, failure is part of what you're trying to achieve. You're trying to know what works and what doesn't work, and that doesn't always jive with people's mindset when they don't appreciate failure personally.
Well, it happens in the humanities, too. You know, I do teach in this directed studies program in which we have fantastic students who come and they choose to be part of this incredibly intense year-long program in literature and philosophy and history and politics, and they write a lot of papers. At the beginning, they don't do so well. And so you're constantly dealing with students who have always gotten A's, and you're giving them something else, and you're talking to them. But as I said when I first came on, that's the first step in any real education. And so that's just a part of the texture of life in my classes. I think the students, they may not like it at the moment, but, you know, as soon as you say, well, don't you think you could write better, that they get it, and they're willing to fail in that way. The question is, when they have so many options at the end of college laid out for them that let them avoid risking something, is it too tempting for them to take those options? And the risk aversion of some of these students is something that I think Bill is right to have noticed. But again, it's something that we can work with.
We're going to be talking more about the humanities and also about diversity at some of these elite colleges and what that might mean for these students, for the future workforce as well. We're talking today with Brian Garston, who is professor of political science in the humanities and chair of the humanities program at Yale University, author of Saving Persuasion, A Defense of Rhetoric and Judgment. We're also talking with Bill Derezowitz. He got us started thinking about this topic with his book, Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. More of your phone calls right after this break, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, planning and zoning, not necessarily the sexiest topic, but it's been in the news a lot lately. It tells us a lot about what matters in our cities and towns. So coming up tomorrow, we'll hear about some recent stories about zoning controversies making waves in different parts of the state. And we'd like to hear from you. What has zoning law done for you lately? That's coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. In his book, Excellent Sheep, Bill Derezowitz has called for the end of elite education altogether, or at least reforming and transforming elite education as we know it today. We're talking about education at the Ivies and other top schools. In one of the arguments he makes, the importance of the humanities is being lost at top colleges to an attitude which promotes more rigid, lucrative studies in hard sciences and in business, careerism. Let's hear some more from some students on the Yale campus about their feelings on this topic.
Do you think that Ivy League schools such as Yale are doing a decent job promoting and teaching the humanities and liberal arts?
I think that they're absolutely doing a good job in the humanities. The Ivy Leagues, I think, stay true to their liberal arts education. They want to make sure that their students have a liberal arts education first and foremost, then branching off into whatever smaller subject that they're looking at.
Well, I'm a history major, and I definitely don't regret my decision to come here. The resources combined with the small size of this institution have made it really a fruitful place to be a humanities major.
I think that Yale is definitely a great place to study the humanities. It would have been very appealing to go to a much smaller liberal arts school in a lot of ways, because I think that the academic environment is a little bit maybe more comforting, but I think you can carve that out for yourself at an Ivy League.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best thing that they do here, at least at Yale. I don't know about other schools.
Are they the best places for it? Maybe not all the time. There's a lot more competition that is very prevalent in the classroom, and it's all kind of feeds into this idea of success and what that might look like, as opposed to maybe figuring out a little bit more what it means to be a human being.
Those are some voices from the Yale campus gathered by our producer for today's show, Josh Nalea. I'll take some of your phone calls as well. Carrie's in Farmington. Hi, Carrie. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I find this program really interesting. I graduated from college about 14 years ago, and I would say I am exactly the student you're describing. I was a very self-driven child. I had very sort of supportive parents. And was encouraged to do extremely well in school, and I did. And I think I grew up being able to say yes and knowing the answers that please people. And I'm fairly certain, looking back, whether I was conscious of it then, that I chose my science major, I chose my entrance into medical school based on, succeeding as high as I could in the educational realm. And looking back, was that the right decision for me? And did it really end up in a career that's as fulfilling to me as had I been more apt to explore things that I liked as opposed to things that I thought were the best?
Well, what do you say? I mean, looking back, did you do the right thing?
I still don't know the answer to that. I enjoyed all of my schooling. I enjoyed, I enjoyed what I learned. But from a careers perspective, there's things I miss in my life. Some of my extracurricular activities that I did sign up for that I loved, I sort of had to put by the wayside in order to succeed academically. And going back, I actually liked some of those better than just my studies. And perhaps I would have found something more fulfilling doing something in the arts, something that wasn't going to end up in a high-powered, high-reward financially career.
Well, Carrie, thank you very much for sharing that story. We got a tweet from our friend Kelly, who we can say is a lawyer with a soul, as we were talking about earlier. She says, I wouldn't give up my Dartmouth experience and my BA in history for anything. Let's hear from some more callers here. Daniel in Stanford. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, first of all, this is one of the very few times I've been able to call in because I teach in a high school, and you're on while I'm working.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to do that. What do you think about the conversation so far?
Well, I think it's really interesting, but I think there's two things that are kind of being left out. I teach AP courses. I also teach non-AP courses, and what's the euphemism is a socioeconomically diverse school in an urban setting. And I see kids from all backgrounds, and I have to write letters for them. I don't have to. I choose to write letters of recommendation to different colleges. And over the past 15 years, there's been a tremendous change in the experience, the application process. And people seem not to ever want to talk about the Common App. Now, years ago, when I applied for college, and I went to an Ivy League institution, too, we applied, and I imagine your two guests applied, to maybe 4 to 8 colleges because it was an onerous process before word processors. These days, a kid can apply to a college, but they fill out the Common App, and they push a button, and they apply to 20 or more colleges, so that the number of applications has increased geometrically? I'm a history guy. not arithmetically, but the number of applicants has not kept pace. And so it is so much more competitive. My two sons, one graduated high school in 2000, one in 2004. In those 4 years, the percentage of acceptances at these elite institutions dropped. and it's because of the number of applications. That's what makes them so, quote, selective, unquote.
Well, Daniel, let me put that. Thank you very much for your phone call. Let me put that to Brian. And, you know, this is an interesting thing we actually haven't talked about a lot, but this is something that frankly happens right now with college students, aspiring college students all the time.
Well, I'm not part of the admissions department at Yale, so I don't know the details of that. I know they're doing tons of outreach to try to reach well-qualified lower-income students who they haven't reached in the past, following research done by economists, that they're out there and they just don't even think to apply to a place like Yale. You know, I think something like 20,000 postcards are now sent highlighting the fact that Yale is need-blind. So there's a lot of outreach being done, but there are more experiments that could be done with the admissions process that might really change things for high schoolers. So Bard College has a great innovation. I think this is the second or third year they're doing it, in which students bypass a normal application altogether if they want. They write 4 essays. They choose from 20-something topics, and college professors at Bard grade the essays, and if they get 3 B pluses, they're in. Mm. So no extracurriculars. I think no SATs even. It's a completely alternate path. And I think perhaps institutions like mine and others should experiment with different admissions policies and trying to make sure that we're getting talent from wherever it exists.
Well, and Bill, we just have a few minutes left, but I'd like you to address that piece of it, this diversity piece of it, making sure that these institutions get a wide range of people from various socioeconomic backgrounds, different parts of the country. That's so important.
Yeah, here's the thing. There's different kinds of outreach happening at different schools. Some schools are doing better than others. Amherst College made a really big push, and they increased their numbers of low-income students. But these institutions are still intensely class stratified. Elite private universities take about 75% of their students from the top quarter and about 3% from the bottom quarter of the income distribution. So it's great that they're trying to do things, but it's really important to understand these are private institutions. They will always need a large percentage of kids who are paying full or most of tuition out of pocket, and a lot of donors who go on to be rich people. And to me, the real answer to this is that we need to step back and say that we have to stop worrying about who can get into Yale and who can get into Bard College or Amherst, and remember that we once made a commitment in this country to free, high-quality, public higher education. And that's the real problem, that we've retreated from that commitment and shifted the burden of paying for college from taxpayers to students and families. You know, caller talked about the Common App. I mean, part of the problem is that everyone is trying to get into the same 12 schools. And those 12 or 20 schools, however you want to cut it, have a few thousand seats every year. And now an increasingly globalized applicant pool. We need hundreds of thousands of seats. We need... You know, my private slogan now is 100 Berkeleys. China has a slogan, 100 Harvards. We need 100 Berkeleys, and Berkeley as it existed in the 70s when it was still free. We need great public universities in every state so that not everyone has to scramble to get into Harvard, Yale, Princeton, or Stanford.
And public universities in every state that will actually accept students from that state sometimes. It's something we've talked a lot about the University of Connecticut. A quick thought on this, Brian? We just have a few seconds, really.
It's true. I mean, if you put together Yale, Harvard, Princeton, Stanford, and MIT, you know, they have fewer students than Ohio State in any given year. So if you're really interested in providing a humanities, liberal arts chance for everyone, the public state universities are the place that we've absolutely got to invest in.
It's a fascinating conversation that I wish we had more time for. You can continue this conversation online at WNPR.org. Brian Garston is the chair of the humanities program at Yale University, author of Saving Persuasion, A Defense of Rhetoric and Judgment. Brian, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to Bill Derezowitz, who is an author, an essayist, literary critic, and he's a former Yale English professor who wrote this book, Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. He got us thinking about this important topic. And Bill, thank you so much for your time.
You're quite welcome.
Our program today was produced by Josh Nalea. Thanks so much to Kyone Wolf and to our executive producer, Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.